And good evening and welcome to this week's edition of Musical Theatre Melodies, a programme which comes to over the airwaves of 96.5 Inner FM every Tuesday evening between the hours of 9 and 11 p.m, broadcasting from our Heidelberg studios in the city of Melbourne. And welcome too to any international or interstate listeners we may have listening in via the World Wide Web. And I'm the host of this programme, Rob Morrison. On tonight's programme, we conclude our trilogy of musicals inspired by the works of Charles Dickens in this, the bicentenary year of Dickens' birth in 1812, with Scrooge, the book, music and lyrics by Leslie Bricus, inspired by Dickens' novella A Christmas Carol, first published in December of 1843. Scrooge is currently playing in revival in the West End at the London Palladium, starring the 75 years young Tommy Steele as the eponymous Ebenezer. But we shall be listening to the original 1992 Birmingham cast recording, starring the one and only Anthony Newley, who is no stranger to Dickens, having played the role of the Artful Dodger as a child actor in the classic David Lean film version of Oliver Twist in 1948. But first, it's my very great pleasure to welcome to the airwaves of 96.5 FM, via telephone from California, the creator of Scrooge, the Academy, Grammy and Ivor Novello award-winning composer, lyricist, librettist and screenwriter, Leslie Bricus. Welcome to Australia, Leslie.
Hello, Robert. How are you?
I'm doing well indeed. And I suppose the first question is, have you ever visited our fair country down under?
Yes, we've been out there many times. My wife, Evie, and I spent our honeymoon there.
Ah, right.
We got married in 1958, and we didn't have much money, but we had lots of time, so we decided to go around the world, which we were able to do through an Australian producer friend that I was working with at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And we were there in Point Piper for 3 months. His sister owned a hotel in Point Piper, which is where we stayed.
Oh, right. Uh-huh. And your impressions of our country?
We love it. Otherwise, we wouldn't keep coming back.
Oh,
we last there 3 or 4 years. We last there 3 or 4 years ago, on our way to New Zealand.
Ah, I see. Well, the works of Charles Dickens have inspired many stage, film, and TV adaptations over the years. But as far as the musical theatre is concerned, the first was Lionel Bart's Oliver in 1960, followed by Pickwick in 1963, for which you provided the lyrics to Cyril Ornadell's music and Wolf Mankiewicz's book. And then, of course, this was subsequently the Academy Award-winning film version of Oliver in 1968. Was it the success of these productions that provided the impetus for your own film adaptation of Scrooge, or did its genesis lay even earlier than that?
No. An American producer living in London, having followed the trend of Dickens, which was very strong in the 1960s,
mm-hmm.
a man called Robert Solo approached me in 1968 or 9, the end of 68, I think it was, about doing a film version. And he put it together through a film company in Hollywood here called Cinema Center Films.
Yes.
And that's how it began.
He asked me to
do all three, book music, screenplay music and lyrics, which made it an easier project for me because I didn't have to collaborate with anyone. It's always easier to do those things on your own.
Indeed, you were able to integrate it in and not have to put up with other people's egos, I guess.
Well, it happened that A Christmas Carol is brilliantly constructed to be a musical because it was written in what Dickens called staves, five staves,
mm-hmm.
and there were five different chapters which kind of went past, present, and future with the three ghosts. So it had a natural shape. And it was very easy to musicalise because Dickens had done most of the work for me.
Yes, yes. And I sat down and watched the film last week in preparation for this interview and was just as enchanted by it as I was as a 9-year-old when I first saw it. And I also noticed that you're in the credits as executive producer. What are the duties of an executive producer?
Well, I was largely involved in helping to assemble the ingredients, particularly the casting.
Mm-hmm.
of the film. The producer was a very young guy, Robert Solo. He did not have very strong connections. He found the link to Cinema Center Films. I was lucky enough to know Ronald Neame, who was to direct the film. And of course, Ronald Neame had a very strong history of connections with Charles Dickens. because he was, as a young man, the producer for David Lean.
Oh, right.
When David Lean made Great Expectations and Oliver Twist.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. So I guess that's how he got Alec Guinness on board too. He played Herbert Pocket.
Well, of course. Mm-hmm. Ronnie Neame had done so many films with him, with Alec Guinness, with David Lean, and indeed without him. He made various films with Ronald Neame as a director. I mean, Neame and Guinness made several films as friends. Tunes of Glory was one film Alec Guinness and John Mills made, which was a very fine film in about 1960, which was not connected with David Lean at all.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
And he brought to the table the repertory of the great old English actors. He brought Edith Evans to the table and Alec Guinness, the various ghosts, and Jacob Marley. But the saga of trying to cast Ebenezer Scrooge was absolutely terrifying. But originally, it was going to be Richard Harris.
Okay.
That was the first choice of Ronnie Neame. But at the time, just about 3 months before we would start shooting, Richard Harris was running late on a film in Israel, and we were told he could not do the film.
Yes.
So I then made contact with Rex Harrison, with whom I had recently worked on Dr. Doolittle, and Rex was very happy to play it. So right up until about a week before we were due to start shooting, it was going to be Rex Harrison.
Oh, okay.
And then Rex was in a play in the West End in London, and he got sick.
Oh, dear.
And he got seriously sick, and we were told by his doctors that he could not do the film.
Mm-hmm.
So we then had 3 days to find an Ebenezer Scrooge, and we were told that it had to be one of three people. It had to be either Richard Burton, Peter O'Toole, or Albert Finney, who were the hot young shots of the day. So I knew that it wouldn't work with Richard Burton because he was doing something else.
Yes.
I had just worked with Peter O'Toole on Goodbye, Mr. Chips, and he was, to his credit, doing something really worthwhile. He was making The Lion in Winter with Catherine Hepburn.
Yes.
So I was left with Albert Finney, and I had 48 hours left. Albert Finney had just married the French actress Anouk and had flown to London, and I tracked him down and went over to his apartment in Westminster and sat up all night with him and Anouk. She cooked us a wonderful dinner, and at 3 o'clock in the morning, he said he would do it, and at 2 o'clock the next afternoon, he was in the costume department at Shepperton Studios.
Yes, yes. And
that's how we got our Scrooge.
And I believe he was only in his 30s at the time, but makes a very convincing elderly Scrooge. But, of course, it works to...
I think Albie was barely 30.
Oh, okay.
Because he was so young, he was able to play the young Scrooge in the early part of the story and the old Scrooge
40
years later, which none of the others would have been able to do.
Mm-hmm.
So we were lucky, O'Toole possibly, but having just worked with Peter, I knew that musically he was a sort of gargantuan actor, but you didn't rate him very highly as a singer.
Mm-hmm.
So Albie coped brilliantly, being both the young and old Scrooge, and he was musically surprisingly good.
Yes, and it's also surprising, too, to have actors of the caliber of Alec Guinness, Kenneth Moore, and Edith Evans didn't sing, but Albert Finney, who did sing in the film. I remember Kenneth Moore had played the Admirable Crichton in both the film and a musical version, but he's not really known as a singer.
No, but he did the one song that he was the ghost of Christmas Present, Kenny Moore.
Mm-hmm.
So with him, we had a very powerful cast, thanks mainly to Ronnie Neame, who had worked with and known these people for decades.
Mm-hmm. And, well, I guess, do you prefer in your professional career actors who sing or singers who act or both?
I prefer singers who act, really. Yes, I think singers who act rather than actors who sing, because actors don't tend to sing as well as singers who act.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. And how long did the film take? It was made at Shepperton Studios in the UK.
Well, we knew before we started that it was opening at Radio City Music Hall in New York in mid-November. So we had an opening date before we started shooting, which was fairly awesome. But we were, thanks to Ronald Neame, who, you know, was vastly experienced. And indeed, Ronnie Neame only left us last year at the age of 99.
Mm-hmm.
He lived a wonderful long life and had good health all his life. I saw him just 2 years ago.
Yes.
And he enjoyed a remarkable career. Not only, he was originally a film editor. And from editor, he became a producer. And producer, he became a director. And so he was one of the most knowledgeable and experienced people ever in British films.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. And I guess then turning to years later when you decided to adapt it, or was it your idea to adapt it as a stage musical or somebody else's?
It was somebody else's, because I couldn't see that one could do anything with a stage musical because of it's such a seasonal piece that you could only perform it for a short time. And I was approached by a young English producer called Graham Mulvane in 1991. And he said, it will work. You can probably run it for 3 months or four before, during, and after Christmas.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So it wasn't a difficult job to adapt it. I wrote more songs is all. I wrote additional songs for the stage version. And we had a long list of possible Scrooges to cast. And then purely by chance, about 3 months before we put it on, my old pal Anthony Newley moved back to England from California, where he'd been living for 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
So the timing was perfect and the search was over. The second he arrived, there were no other contestants as far as I was concerned.
Yes.
And he was totally wonderful in the part.
Yes, and of course your collaboration with Anthony Newley is well known in such stage musicals as Stop the World, I Want to Get Off, Roar of the Grease Paint, Smell of the Crowd, The Good Old Bad Old Days, and films as well. How did you first meet Anthony Newley?
I first met Newley, appropriately, on my way back from Australia.
Oh, okay.
On our honeymoon, we came back on a P&O liner, and I heard a voice singing on the ship's sound system one evening, and I said, that's Anthony Newley. I must go and see him.
Mm-hmm.
Because I had written some songs while I was in Australia.
Yes.
Including one which was, the lyric was entirely made up of Australian place names.
Oh, okay. Uh-huh.
The title of the song was Tumbarumba, and the entire lyric was Australian place names all the way through. Anyway,
Has it ever been commercially recorded?
I tracked him down at Decca Studios in London,
mm-hmm.
One evening in 1959, and we became instant pals. But we didn't write anything together for another couple of years. And we somehow knew we could. We were just able to write songs together, even though we never tried.
Yes.
And that friendship lasted until he left us in 1999.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the first person to bring Scrooge to London's West End. The Dominion Theatre in London was the first time Scrooge came to London.
Yes.
Having toured the country for a season each year from 92 onwards.
And looking at some of the other cast members of the original 1992 Birmingham stage production, you have such interesting people as Stratford Johns and a former Doctor Who, John Pertwee, as Jacob Marley.
John Pertwee was and remains the most hilariously brilliant ghost of Marley that we ever had. No one came close. He was absolutely superb.
Mm-hmm. And, well, he had a musical career too, I believe. Irene, I have him in the cast recording, and the Arcadians. He even does a very good impression of Alfred Lester on that, and various other things as well.
Yes, he was a very clever fellow.
Indeed.
Clever family, actually. The Pertwee family contributed quite a few people to the industry.
And I had the pleasure of seeing the stage production when it was performed in Melbourne at the Princess Theatre back in November of 1993 with Keith Michelle in the title role.
That's right. And we came over for that. And, of course, Melbourne's temperature at that time of year is hardly Arctic.
No, exactly.
So it was He was a rather hot Scrooge covered in fur. I remember they did a street parade through Melbourne. And it was about 108 degrees or something. But he was a lovely man, Keith, Michelle. I hope he's flourishing. Newley and I actually wrote part of The Roar of the Grease Paint in his house.
Oh, okay.
Because Tony married Joan Collins, and when they got married, the four of us were great pals. We still are great pals with Joni.
Mm-hmm.
And we wrote a lot of the score. They rented Keith Michelle's house in Hampstead in London. He was in Australia.
Yes.
And that's where we wrote Roar of the Grease Paint.
Ah, right. And Roar of the Grease Paint starred another great Australian too, in Cyril Richard.
Ah, yes. He was fabulous. Wonderful. Wonderful man.
And I believe the good old bad old days also had a very big Australian contingent too, including Bill Kerr.
Yes, Bill Kerr. Lovely Bill Kerr. That's right. My golly, I didn't realise how many of your pals we have with us.
Oh, indeed. I believe Bill is still alive and well and living in Perth in Western Australia out here too.
Ah, how wonderful.
So, perhaps we might get him onto the program to discuss the good old bad old days at some stage.
That would be nice. I do remember, speaking of Perth, we came back on this P&O liner, and we came, as the ship came in the sort of Perth-Fremantle area on the west coast, there were huge signs on the cliffs offering land for sale for 10 shillings an acre.
Oh, okay.
10 shillings an acre. And I said to Evie, I don't know if we're ever going to come back here, but for £5, it might be worth a little investment.
Indeed, yes. And no doubt you'd be a multimillionaire if you'd invested at the time, but I'm sure you possibly are, although I shouldn't go into that.
Well, it was 1959, so check it out. That was, what, just over 50 years ago.
Yes, indeed.
Good opportunity for anybody.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I believe another of your countrymen, Daniel Radcliffe, has an apartment out in Melbourne, and he likes visiting here in our summer months to watch the cricket. So I guess that's an attraction for many English people to escape the cold winters over there.
Yes, we have cricketing pals who go. Michael Parkinson, who spends a lot of time. Do you know Michael Parkinson?
Oh, certainly, yes. His TV series was shown on the ABC TV out here. Yeah,
yeah, well, Parky. I think every winter he and his wife Mary go to Australia. We see him obviously in London a lot, but I know he loves Australia and is a great cricket freak.
Indeed, is that something that you follow yourself, or?
Yes, I mean, I am the man who saw Don Bradman get out for a duck.
Ah.
In the final test he ever played, which stopped him having a lifetime average of 100.
Oh, right.
He ended up with 99.94.
So you're sitting in on one of the great historical moments of cricket history.
Yes, I've never forgotten it, because I was a schoolboy during the series in 1948, and my school was only a 10-minute walk from Lord's Cricket Ground, so I was luckily located. And schoolboys were allowed in for nothing after the tea break.
Oh, I see.
Every day. And the 1948 series, when I think Australia had the best cricket team ever assembled in the history of the world, you know, it was a remarkable team. Keith Biller and, you know, all the young ones were there, and the best bowling team. Don Tallon was your wicketkeeper. It was an extraordinary team. And they were a joy to watch.
Yeah, I believe they were unbeaten during that whole English tour too.
Oh yes, I mean they were supermen. They were beyond cricketers. They were quite fabulous.
Well, looking back over your biographical notes, apparently you were influenced by the early Hollywood film musicals. I guess the MGM musicals, specifically Words and Music, the Rodgers and Hart biopic. And one thing they always ask composers or lyricists is, what comes first, the music or the lyrics? Well, being a combined composer-lyricist, what does come first with you? Or do they both come at the same time?
The title comes first.
Oh, the title, uh-huh. That's the inspiration. Mm-hmm.
Well, nearly everything I write, I very seldom have written songs that were just songs. I have always written in the context of a story, because I've always been fascinated by musicals.
Yes.
And the MGM musicals of that era, the Gene Kelly, Judy Garland, Fred Astaire, when MGM had this phenomenal collection of talent put together by a songwriter who became a producer called Arthur Freed.
Yes, yes.
During the war years, I was a schoolboy, and I used to sneak down into the West End against all the rules because we had the Blitz going on.
Oh, okay.
But getting to the Empire Leicester Square was more important than the Blitz.
Mm-hmm.
And after school, I would run down there. I saw films like the one you mentioned at least 25 times each.
Yes, yes.
On the Town, all those wonderful musicals where Gene Kelly's career was just blooming and blossoming, and he was becoming a choreographer and a director as well as the best dancer in history other than lovely Fred Astaire.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sitting at the moment across the street. When we came here the first time, right across the street was Danny Kaye lived directly across the street.
Oh, okay.
Next door to a house now occupied by David Beckham,
yes,
footballer.
Mm-hmm.
And up the road was Fred Astaire.
Ah.
And around the corner was Gene Kelly and Ira Gershwin. So I got to know all those wonderful people.
All right.
During that era, I was very lucky.
All your childhood idols, you finally got to meet them.
Yep. Oh. I really got to meet my heroes. I met Gene Kelly when he walked into my office at 20th Century Fox and asked me to write a song for his film. That was one of the great... I nearly fell on the floor. That was one of the great moments of my life. I really did worship the man. He was worth worshipping too. He was a wonderful man. A wonderful man.
Indeed, yes. Oh, I guess favourite songs over your career. Do you have any favourites that you particularly enjoy or...
Well, I like the song. Well, I've written quite a lot of songs about my wife. That started way back. Every score I wrote one song for Evie,
mm-hmm,
starting with an individual song called My Kind of Girl, which Matt Monro and Frank Sinatra recorded. That was in the early 60s. Sammy Davis did it, Nat King Cole, Dean Martin, a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had a song for her in pretty well every score about her, so they've got a nice collection of those. My favorite songs, the song Pure Imagination from Willy Wonka.
I like
that a lot.
Yes,
that's
yes.
A sweet song. And another song that from Roar of the Grease Paint that came back from the past was a song called Feeling Good, which was from the Roar of the Grease Paint. And Michael Bublé did a brilliant recording of it about 6 or 7 years ago, which completely brought it back. It had originally been a hit for Nina Simone in the 60s. And
yes.
Then when Bublé did it, it caused a bunch of other recordings to happen, which have... continued to add to its nice history.
Indeed, yes. And thinking back in the 1960s and 70s, there seemed to be quite a large amount of family musicals that came out at that time, and I remember you were responsible for Dr. Dolittle and, of course, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. Do you feel that the quality of children's or family musicals is around the same, or has it decreased over the years?
Well, I think the quality of songs that are popular has dropped badly. I think a lot of popular songs have virtually non-existent lyrics. They have a lot of noises, and I don't think the gift of melody is as well spread around as it used to be.
No.
A generation ago.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not a fan of a lot of popular music today. Great songs can happen when you have the right people doing them. And to get the sustained quality, I mean, if you played the best 20 songs by the Beatles in the 60s and then played the best 20 songs that have been written in this decade, I think there would be a very large gap for the worse.
Yes, yes, and I guess many of the songs of today won't really be around in 50 years' time, which... a lot of the ones of the 60s, such as that you've written and the Beatles, Lennon and McCartney and Lionel Bart and various other composers are still with us even today.
Well, I think, you know, the musicals that will last, I think, you know, the Sondheim musicals are probably the best constructed. He is the cleverest writer from the last 50 years. Steve Sondheim was only 25 when he wrote the lyrics for West Side Story, mm-hmm. and then Gypsy when he was 27, and he started composing at exactly the same time Newley and I went to Broadway with Stop the World, I Want to Get Off. He had a show called A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum.
Ah, right.
Written with two great comedic writers, Bert Shevlov and Larry Gelbart. And it was the first time Steve wrote music and lyrics. And that continued, you know, he had a rather low-key 1960s, but he suddenly kept hitting home runs from 1970 onwards. Company, Follies, Little Night Music, Sweeney Todd, lots and lots of them. My favorite show of his is slightly less well-known, which is called Sunday in the Park with George.
Oh, yes, yes, about George Surratt.
Mm-hmm. Very clever.
No, coincidentally, A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum is currently playing in revival in Melbourne with Geoffrey Rush as Pseudolus, the slave.
Oh, wonderful. What a great piece of casting that is.
And Stephen Sondheim...
I love his...
Oh, sorry. Yeah, Stephen Sondheim came out last month to do a workshop, an afternoon with Stephen Sondheim. So I had the pleasure of sitting in the audience and listening to the man himself talk about his work.
Wonderful. The big hit musical in London at the moment is an adaptation of Roald Dahl's Matilda. And I think the young writers are Australian.
Oh, that's correct. Yes, Tim Minchin.
They are the boys that did South Park, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, they are. South Park cartoon team wrote Matilda, which is, we saw it just before we left London, and it's opening on Broadway in 2030.
Ah, great. No doubt it'll come to Australia too, I believe.
Oh, I'm sure.
Well, I'd like to thank you very much, Leslie, for taking the time to speak to us in Australia and tell us all about our featured musical tonight, Scrooge, and the inspiration behind it, and also to cover various other aspects of your career. So, a Merry Christmas to you and yours.
And to you, Robert. I enjoy chatting with you, and I wish I were out there. Even though it's lovely here in California, I'm sure it's even better there, and I'd love to be there next month for the tennis.
A great tennis fan, too. Well, perhaps you might return to Australia with your wife again one of these days, too, and we might have the pleasure of seeing you in person.
Thank you. That's wonderful. I look forward. Yes, in fact, I think I will be out there for a new production of Scrooge, which I believe is happening a year from now.
Ah, great. Great. Well,
okay, Robert.
Thank you very much for your time, Leslie.
Happy holidays to you.
Thank you.
Be well, and I'll talk to you soon.
Certainly. Thank you. Bye for now.
Thank you. Bye-bye.